Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. For over 2 months, demonstrators have been gathering in Kiev's central independent square to voice their frustration with the government. What began as a peaceful rally in support of Ukrainian integration into the EU intensified following a brutal police crackdown. Then earlier this month, the street protests turned violent after the country's parliament passed sweeping legislation aimed at curbing the demonstrations. The government has since backed away from those laws, but an official repeal has yet to be signed, and the country's president last week proposed a power-sharing deal with opposition leaders. The protests, known as Euromaidan, continue on and have now spread to other cities with the goal of pushing for the resignation of President Viktor Yanukovych. And just yesterday, President Yanukovych, citing health concerns, announced he was going on sick leave, further complicating the likelihood of a political resolution in the near future. Today on Global Journalist, we'll talk about the crisis in the Ukraine and also what the future holds for the country. And joining me now, Nikolai Petro is a professor of politics at the University of Rhode Island and a visiting scholar at Odessa National University in Ukraine. Katerina Panova is a freelance photojournalist who just returned to New York after a two-week stint in Kiev earlier this month. And thanks to both of you for joining us today on Global Journalist. Nikolai, let's start with you. You know, it would be easy to characterize the violence and the recent unrest as something that evolved around the EU integration versus sort of an allegiance to the Russian economy. But it's much more complicated than that, isn't it, with the president's background and the history of his rule, corruption, cronyism, heavy-handed police tactics, those kinds of things. Give us a little bit of perspective, will you?
It all crystallized around the accession to the EU, which the government, everyone agrees, the government handled very badly by giving the impression that it was going to sign the agreement until the very last moment and then turning around 180 degrees and essentially receiving aid from Russia, economic aid from Russia, that results in the suspicion for many that the Ukraine economy is going to be more rather than less integrated.
And let's talk about the sticking points there, because you do get the sense that many Ukrainians feel that the EU offers better economic opportunity in the short and perhaps the long term, but it's also sort of the historical ties to Russia that might be problematic here. Yes,
problematic for some Ukrainians, but a very positive and desired aspect for other Ukrainians. That's one of the issues making this a difficult political choice, is that the country seems very divided about where its allegiances lie. That is to say, ideally it should lie with Ukraine itself, but within the context of Ukrainian politics, some lean toward a closer relationship with Russia, and others lean toward a closer relationship with the EU. Unfortunately, those are seen as opposing choices rather than complementary choices.
And all of this coming to the head really in November, when these protests really escalated to another level. There was violence that had not yet been seen before that point, and that has significantly changed the tenor of what's going on there, Nikolai.
Well, I would say that just as the political elite is divided, I would say that there's more than one faction in the opposition as well. I would define them as the official political opposition, the three major opposition parties, which have parliamentary factions, and then alongside those, a group of more radically oriented nationalists who have been the leaders in the violent outbreaks of the last 2 weeks. And they seem to have their own agenda now. And it's very difficult to know under whose control they are, if anyone's. And one of the problems that led, I think, to the failure of the recently agreed to compromise between the opposition and the president was the inability of the leaders of the opposition to guarantee that they could fulfill their part of the deal. The deal was, the deal on the table, I guess, still is, that in exchange for a blanket amnesty of all the participants in the Maidan on the Independence Square actions, that over the course of the next 2 weeks, all of the building, the government buildings in Kyiv and elsewhere in the country would be vacated over the course of 2 weeks.
Right, but, and important to note that these protesters have in fact taken over several of the government buildings there in Kyiv. They've occupied even the Ministry of Justice, among other things.
Temporarily, right. That's right. Now been vacated.
Right.
But they're continuing to hold on to several buildings. The city hall, Kyiv City Hall, has been in their control since December 1st. And they've recently expanded into seizing control in a number of other regions of the country, in the west primarily. In other regions, including Odessa, they have been fought back, essentially, and the local government has retained control.
And Katerina Panova, this would be a good opportunity to bring you in because you've just returned from Kyiv, and you were actually able to go down to what is, for all intents and purposes, the front lines, and talk about sort of, first of all, your experience there, because I know that it's quite intimidating, and yet at the same time, there seems to be a lot of civility that is going on amidst what has to be very chaotic.
Well, it was a very intense experience indeed, and it was chaotic. Like, I would like just to comment on like what was said before. Like, just in my opinion, the protests and the fighting on the street and the whole situation, which is kind of feels like the edge of a civil war, has nothing to do with the European Union and fighting against Russian influence. In my opinion. That's what I experienced on the streets, and that's what it feels like. Like, there are nobody talking about European Union at this point. It's like an attempt to overturn the government.
Right, and talk a little bit more about that, because Viktor Yanukovych consolidated quite a bit of power. He brought in a lot of cronies into the government. Is that where the frustration is? That and the dubious courts, the heavy-handed police actions? Is it sort of all rolled into one, and is that what is making this so palpable?
Yes. I would say that at first people indeed protested against the government's unwillingness to sign the agreement with the European Union. But after a bunch of students were attacked by police and beaten, lots of Ukrainians were shocked because, you know, like, we were a peaceful country. We didn't have that kind of violence in our history since, like, the Middle Ages. So people just went on the streets and they wanted the government to answer their questions, like, why did you beat the students? Why did you imply violence? Where, like, you know, why did you start violence? It was November 30s. So what it like felt as a peaceful protest on the morning of January 19th when I was there, and people were like creative, wearing masks and calendars on their heads and like carnival outfits. And at some point, one of the opposition leaders went to the square and started to deliver flowery speeches. And the crowd started booing on them because, like, everybody was fed up with talking. They wanted to walk the walk, not talk the talk, you know, like to have real results rather than talks. So one of the activists, like, asks the crowd, like, whether we should probably go to the parliament and ask to cancel the laws. And the crowd widely supported him. And everybody went to the parliament. And that's where the protesters met the police, and the violence started.
And that violence really came quite close to you, did it not? I mean, you were in the crowd, and we have heard reports of dozens of journalists who have been injured while covering these events, and you saw that firsthand. Explain what happened.
Well, like up to now, there are like 63 journalists who were injured during the protests. So like, I know personally like lots of them. And there was at least one case when the journalists were injured by the protesters, but the most cases the journalists were like harmed and aimed by the police. And like what my colleagues believe, it was done on purpose.
And someone was standing next to you and was shot in the forehead with a rubber bullet. You thought that they had actually been shot, yes?
Well, for me as a journalist who never covered, war or whatever, because, we're a peaceful country, that was, shocking experience because, I never seen violence on the streets. So there was, smoke and fire everywhere, and, it was almost impossible to breathe. I didn't have a gas mask. So it was looked like a horrible Hollywood movie or something in my hometown. And yes, the person standing right next to me was shot and he fell down. And I, as the paramedics just appeared instantly, there were the medics who support the protesters and help them. And they just told, "You'll be okay. It's a rubber bullet." But I was scared. I mean, after I left, I was thinking, was this bullet aimed at me? Because I was standing right next to him, and I was pretty obviously a journalist.
It certainly has to be a harrowing experience. Historically, Nikolai, let's talk about some people would like to draw correlations between the Orange Revolution and these actions of late. What are the similarities? What are the differences?
Well, the Orange Revolution of 2004 was much more focused because it came about as a result of disagreements over the validity of the counting of the election. So there were two leaders on each side, and you basically had one choice or the other. The situation today is much more complicated because, in fact, there is no clear strategy among any of the political actors, it seems to me. But the political opposition has as its agenda to anticipate the upcoming presidential election. So to bring those closer to term, to have them sooner rather than wait until February 2015.
Right.
Beyond that, they also want to undo the changes, the most recent changes to the Ukrainian constitution, and return it to the status quo of 2004. That's one part of the agenda. But beyond that, those three parties are very difficult, are very much in disagreement with each other about what to do next for the rest of the country. And if they do actually accomplish those two goals, I'm sure they'll go back to their traditional political infighting amongst themselves.
And I want to get to the resignation of the Prime Minister, Mykola Azarov, in a moment. But, Katerina, you were, from a journalist's perspective, you covered both. You covered the Orange Revolution, and you've been now to Kiev recently. Any correlations another perspective on that?
Well, first of all, I would say that now it feels on the streets that there is no actual power in hands of the opposition politicians. So whatever they kind of go and negotiate with the president, they have to listen to the crowd because the crowd is not really kind of big friends with them, and the crowd is not really listening to the opposition politicians as well. So I would call it now the direct democracy, which felt on the streets.
Right.
And it is really unique for it didn't feel like that during the Orange Revolution. Indeed, Peter told, it was more focused on the re-elections and questioning whether the previous elections were real or frauded. And like this time also it feels like people are so much like crowdsourcing lots of things. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there are like lots of volunteering and lots of support. For example, I personally know some people who are like patrolling the city in their cars, like to like avoid the bandits destroying some, like, you know, provoking people. And some of these people are not like young people or students, but they're like retired or like in their 40s or 50s. So like there's like a huge uprising of like, you know, people's interests to like make their country better, which is like an incredible feeling and experience there.
And there is, there's the added. Oh, yeah.
I maybe add just to that very point that speaking to the issue of direct democracy, the country is very different region to region. So here in Odessa, people look at what's happening in Kiev and say, that's not for us. That definitely what's happening there, this kind of tumult and chaos, that's something that people here would actually like to avoid. I suspect in what's happened in the West shows that there are many more people who would like to go further and sort of sweep away, you know, all the archaic structures of power and things like that. But the East is much more reluctant to do so. And there is, and I think it's important to note, a strong reservoir of support for law and order. Who's going to bring that law and order is now a question mark.
Yeah,
people assumed it would be the Party of Regions. But if the Party of Regions doesn't do it, I think local governments in the East and South will guarantee it themselves.
The Party of Regions being Viktor Yanukovych's party.
Dominant.
Go ahead. And then I want to talk about your discussion of power vacuum. But go ahead, Katerina, if you have something quick to add on that.
No,
point.
I was just saying that, like, unfortunately, like, yeah, our country is like really like divided, probably like culturally.
Right.
To some extent. So yes, like Party of Regions is incredibly like popular in the East and South of Ukraine. And it's like really not supported in the center and Western Ukraine. So, yeah.
And this is partly a problem of the age of the country and of the geographic distribution of the country and of historical sorts of, you know, the languages that are preferred and that kind of thing. Let's talk a little bit about this power vacuum and about the possibility of transition. You know, you do have UDAR, the Ukrainian Democratic Alliance. You have the Fatherland Party. Is Vitaly Klitschko, you know, is he a possible successor in this, or is he seen more as a national hero and more as a figurehead? I understand that he lacks some sort of charismatic appeal to the masses.
Well, we don't really know because he is too new a political figure to say that he has been tested and approved by the populace. UDAR, his political party, is very recent as well.
And what about Arseniy Yatsenyuk?
Yatsenyuk is a much better known figure. He began his political career under the wings of the Party of Regions and then moved to the Batkivshina. And he is now the spokesman, the key political figure for them. Waiting in the wings, however, within that particular political movement, Batkivshina, the Fatherland Party, is Yulia Tymoshenko. She was the reason, ostensibly, for the EU's delay in signing the association agreement. Her release was going to be one of the demands that the EU put. That was also an issue initially in the first week or so of the Maidan movement, and then that issue sort of disappeared along with EU integration itself. So if her whole fate, I'm sure she would be released in any change, if there any change of government were to take place, but whether she would be welcomed back by any of the current political groups is a big question in my mind.
Sure, Katerina, you, being in the on the front with a lot of these folks and talking with them, did you get a sense that there? It's clear that the resignation of the prime minister, the dissolution of the cabinet, you know, and the fact that they have to be replaced in some 60 days, that is not enough for these folks. They will stop at nothing short of Yanukovych's resignation. But to the question of what comes next, did they have a good answer for that?
I mean, like as I told before, like I clearly believe that the opposition leaders have little to no influence on what is happening on the streets, and so they're just like voicing the opinion of the crowd to the government, to the president. That's like what I experienced and heard when I heard Yatsenyuk and Klitschko and. There was also another like opposition leader,
Tanyabok.
Yes, Tanyabok. Like talking to the crowd from the tribunes, like they're booed lots of times.
Okay, we have lost like, the clarity of what you're saying there. So back to Nikolai for just a second.
Sure.
So. Where does this go? Because we keep talking about the brink of civil war, and we keep talking about what comes next. And with Yanukovych now sick, it could be a delay tactic, and that means no resolution of any kind, right?
Well, the resolution or not of the conflict will not revolve around the president's health, except insofar as he might decide to resign. That would be the only way to remove him from power. There's an Article 108 of the Constitution provides for the president to choose to resign, and then elections are held in 90 days. But what exactly will the results of such an election be? One of the things that I am struck by is that while much of the attention has focused on the political opposition and their strength or their determination to change the political system, I would highlight the fact that the existing political majority in parliament, the Party of Regions, is still the largest party. And their supporters and their determination has also strengthened as well. So I'm not at all sure that whoever is nominated by the Party of Regions as essentially the law and order candidate for Ukraine would not indeed win elections. And then what would the opposition do in that case? Would they even accept the results of such an election?
But certainly there have to be moderates that exist within Yanukovych's Party of Regions that might be, frankly, not Yanukovych and thus more appealing to those who might not sit within the Party of Regions camp, yes?
There are people in Yanukovych's party, and I'm sure on the other side, whom we would call moderates. But whether or not they would be seen as such, especially by the people, as Katerina mentioned quite rightly, in the streets, is a huge question mark. There are groups of radical nationalists like the Right Sector who dismiss all political associations, all political parties, as essentially manifestations of oppression and want to do away with the entire political system and come up with an alternative to parliamentary democracy, which would not involve political competition. Would they be satisfied? Obviously, they cannot be satisfied by anything in the political process. Will the government at this point or after the elections be strong enough to restrain them? Is the question.
Sure. And before we continue the discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcast at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. This week, we have a timeline of the protests, an article about the geographic divide in Ukraine. Please send us any questions, comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or at our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at globaljourn. And one last question with time running out just a bit here, and that regards the economic sort of vice that Ukraine finds itself in one way or the other. $15 billion in loans Russia offered to Ukraine back in December. Now the U.S. Is threatening economic sanctions should Yanukovych take a harder stance against the protests. This really puts Ukraine in a vice, Nikolai, and really makes it difficult on another level, does it not?
Well, sanctions, I think, will have little impact.
Will they? Okay.
Yeah, because they're essentially, if you're going to be removed from power entirely, what difference do sanctions make? Obviously, people are now fighting for political survival and perhaps even for more than political survival. In the current circumstances, with respect, why did Ukraine turn to Russia rather than the EU? Because Russia came up with money, and the EU came up with nothing. Right. Now, if the EU had come up with a concrete program, which they refused to do, then maybe the discussion would be different. But that was the whole reason that former Prime Minister Azarov went on television and said, we had no choice here but to go with the money in the short term. No one argues, by the way, in the government or in the opposition, but including the government, that the long-term goal is association with the EU. But the argument essentially of the government is we can't afford to do that right now.
Okay, with just about 30 seconds each, I try to look in your crystal ball and give us a short-term either prediction or solution. Katarina, let's start with you.
Well, I see that the solution could be president resigning and a new presidential elections being held and new parliamentary elections also being held. Another possible solution, which sounds really horrible, but there is a possibility of it, is the country being divided into two parts. And, well, the third resolution could be I'm done.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's a good perspective. And Nikolai, last word. Those two solutions or outcomes seem likely to you. One of them.
I think in the short term, I do think the president will probably resign, and that's an obvious course to take to hold new elections. I don't think new elections, however, are any guarantee that a solution to the ongoing political divisions in the country will be resolved. What is actually needed is what Europeans call a government of national unity, getting people on both sides together to actually take responsibility for the future of the country.
Okay, and we're going to have to take that as the final word, and I'm sorry, we're terribly short of time. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a good discussion, and we've come to the end of this edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today were freelance photojournalist Katarina Panova and political science professor Nikolai Petro. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Kyle Felling. Raymond Tugakar is the executive producer. Olga Krustuleva and Victoria Mitskute were our producers this week. Please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink.